You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
When Congress went into recess at the end of last week, they left several important bills unfinished. Today, in the second part of our Legislative Leftover series, we look at where the debate over the proposed cap-and-trade system to curb global warming currently stands, with Elizabeth Colbert, who writes about the environment, among other things, for The New Yorker, and Juliet Alperin, an environmental reporter for The Washington Post. And I'm very pleased to welcome both of them to our show today. Hello.
Good morning. Hi there.
Elizabeth, I'll bet the majority of Americans have no idea what a cap-and-trade system is and how theoretically it might work.
Yes, well, that's sort of the point, to be honest. I mean, a cap-and-trade system is, one of the reasons that it's being debated by Congress right now is that it's seen as more sort of politically palatable than a straight-on tax on carbon emissions. What would happen under a cap-and-trade bill, like the bill that did pass the House, is that you'd set an overall cap on carbon emissions, and then you'd sort of apportion the allowances to, large emitters. It's supposed to be sort of an upstream cap, as they call it, so it would go to where the big emissions are coming from, so power plants, oil refineries, things like that. And then if you were one of these emitters and you came in under your allowance, you would have these tradable permits that would then be traded on a carbon market. And if you were an emitter who came in over your allowance, you would have to buy allowances. And the idea is that the cap would then be ratcheted down over time, and over time our carbon emissions would go down. So that's the basic idea.
Is it designed to limit pollutants and provide incentives for emitters to be cleaner? Couldn't it lead to more polluting by companies that decide it's just more cost-effective to continue polluting in the end?
Well, there's a limit on the number of allowances. So, at least certainly in theory, and I'd like to say in practice, too, it shouldn't lead to more than we're emitting now, because you're only giving out a fixed number of permits. That's the point. So there are only a fixed number in circulation, and depending on how many people can come in under their cap and how many can't, that's going to determine the price on an open market.
Juliet, doesn't a functioning cap-and-trade system have its origins with C. Boyden Gray, who worked in both the Ronald Reagan and George H.W. Bush administrations?
Well, I'm familiar with Boyden Gray, and yes, this is something he's worked on, but basically what you're alluding to is that the cap-and-trade system that has been functioning for quite a while in the United States deals with acid rain, that essentially when scientists identified acid rain as a serious problem, particularly in the Northeast, what they decided to do is the best way to limit sulfur dioxide is to implement this kind of cap-and-trade system for those emissions from power plants and other facilities. And it actually has been extraordinarily successful. It's one of the things that people point to, that before it was adopted, it was very controversial. Emitters said that they wouldn't be able to limit their emissions in an affordable way, and it actually achieved its reductions relatively quickly at a small fraction of the cost of what was originally anticipated. So it's not something that's novel. It's actually something that the United States has pioneered as kind of, again, it was, as you're pointing out, a somewhat conservative alternative to the idea of a straight cap on pollutants, a straight tax on pollutants.
And since it was effective, why are we having so much trouble now? The House Energy and Commerce Committee started work on this recent bill 5 months ago in April.
Well, the fact of the matter is that carbon emissions play a much greater role in our society. I mean, they affect so many parts of everyone's individual lives as well as businesses. So the financial stakes are tremendously high, particularly because you have a number of states in the Midwest who have been getting cheap electricity for years because they've been dependent on coal and other emissions. And so as a result, you're talking about a financial stake that's order of magnitude different from what we saw in the acid rain debate.
What did House leaders set out to accomplish with the Waxman-Markey bill, and what kind of legislation did they end up eventually passing in June?
It's a good question, because those are very different scenarios. Essentially, Henry Waxman, who in fact pioneered the idea of global warming legislation in the House, had initially hoped to reduce our global or our greenhouse gas emissions by 20% compared to 2005 levels by 2020. This is actually not hugely ambitious in the grand scheme of things, but certainly represented a real cut. And he had to scale back on that. They scaled back to a 17% cut, which basically would bring us level to where we were in 1990, which is the benchmark that most nations use in international negotiations over climate change. And significantly, both President Obama and Henry Waxman and Ed Markey had initially proposed selling, auctioning off all these pollution allowances that Elizabeth referred to, in other words, to generate a lot of money that could be put into different programs. And under tremendous pressure from utilities and other groups, they ended up giving away, under the House bill, 85% of the allowances, whether it's to consumers or utilities. That's obviously a huge revenue stream, which essentially is money they doled out in order to pass the bill.
Elizabeth, so is this cost effective? The Congressional Budget Office estimated that an auction of carbon allowances could raise $989 billion in proceeds over 10 years, but the bill as written would only raise $276 billion. The Congress has chosen to take a $713 billion loss.
Well, that's, I'm not an economist, but what economists would tell you was right. That's basically a transfer of money. We've decided, as opposed to putting that money into the public treasury, we've sort of elected to keep that in private hands. Now, you can debate whether that's a good idea, and I think, certainly many people would argue it was not a good idea and that we could have used that money in the public treasury and we could have used it to put it toward achieving the goals of the bill and going beyond the goals of the bill. But that, that is a decision that was made. So that's sort of just a transfer of wealth issue. Now, the question of whether the whole system will work cost-effectively, that is the whole point of a bill like this, is people are going to make, the most cost-efficient cuts. It costs them money to emit, so you're going to get, people thinking of cost-effective ways to cut their emissions. And, that's the whole idea. This is, to sort of take advantage of the efficiencies of a capitalist system. What the bill is really doing, what people talk about, is that the price of emitting carbon into the atmosphere, which has a cost for all of us because it's heating up the planet, will then be factored in to the cost of goods. So it's what economists refer to as an externality, and you'll now make it part of the good, as we do with many pollutants. We make basically the cost of dealing with that part of the cost of the good. And since we've sort of just used the atmosphere and made it free for everyone to emit into, we've emitted too much. That's the basic point here.
But the goal now is just 17%, 1990 emissions. And 1990, we already had concerns about global warming.
Well, yes. As Juliet said, it's not a very, in the grand scheme of things, the scientists will tell you, I think there's a very widespread consensus that if we want to avert, really potentially catastrophic climate change, we have to start maxing out global emissions. Let's say I'm going to choose a figure that's widely used in 2020. Okay, so the curve, which has been going very steadily, it's not a curve, it's sort of a straight line upward, has been going very steadily upward year after year after year for decades now, has to peak, and then it has to start coming down. And when people look at that, they say, well, especially because emissions are growing very fast in the developing world, and when you think about it, those people are emitted a lot less historically, and they emit a lot less now than we do. We are among the per capita in the U.S., we have among the very, very highest emissions in the world per person. It's really our responsibility to start coming down sooner. So let's say 2015 or 2012. That is not very long from now, right, when you think about it. It's 2009 now. So, the clock is ticking, and we really don't have a lot of time to get going here.
Doesn't the European Union already have an emissions trade system for greenhouse gases?
Yes, they do, and that's definitely been the backdrop for a lot of these discussions. And in the early years of the trading scheme, which was sort of considered an experimental data-gathering phase, the system didn't work well. Too many permits were given out, and the price of the permit basically collapsed, so there was no incentive for anyone to cut their emissions. Now, since then, things have been tightened up, and people, it has not been working very long under this sort of non-experimental phase, but there are many people who would argue that it basically is working now. So I would guess I would basically say the jury is still somewhat out on that system, but it showed that, you know, you could take a system and learn from it. And unless we actually put a system in place, we certainly can't start learning from it.
Is our system going to be anything like the EU system?
Yes, it's going to be quite similar to the EU system. I mean, in theory, all of these systems are very simple. They all have certain structural similarities now along the edges in terms of what you do with the revenues, in terms of how you apportion the credits, things like that. There's a lot of room to maneuver, and some people would say there's way too much room to maneuver and manipulate the system. But the fundamentals are pretty much the same.
My guests are The New Yorker's Elizabeth Colbert and Washington Post's Juliet Alperin. We're talking about the cap-and-trade legislation that was left hanging when Congress went into recess as part of a two-part series on our show called Legislative Leftovers. Juliet, the EPA only listed greenhouse gases as a threat to the public in early spring. Was awaiting that classification one of the many barriers that kept Congress from even taking up global warming legislation for so long?
Well, really, its delay reflects simply the different approach of the Bush administration, which was very resistant to the idea of setting mandatory federal limits on greenhouse gas emissions. And so it's actually what you're pointing out is there's a separate track that essentially, because EPA has now said for the first time that greenhouse gases are in fact a pollutant, they now could potentially have the ability to regulate it even if Congress doesn't act. But what it reflects is the intense resistance that we saw over 8 years by the Bush administration, which just refused to have any kind of cap on greenhouse gas emissions. And so certainly it's an indicator of how things have changed in Washington. But one thing it indicates is that to some extent the Obama administration has been more aggressive in what it wants to do on climate change, and it's running into the political realities of congressional districts where there's certainly more reluctance to cap these gases.
In an editorial for the Bismarck Tribune, North Dakota Senator Byron Dorgan, a Democrat, wrote in opposition to a cap and trade system, saying, "I know the Wall Street crowd can't wait to sink their teeth into a new trillion-dollar trading market in which hedge funds and investment banks would trade and speculate on carbon credits and securities. In no time, they'll create derivatives, swaps, and more in that market," which is a real concern. But also, 10 moderate Senate Democrats from states dependent on coal and manufacturing sent a letter to President Obama saying that they wouldn't support any climate change bill that didn't protect American industries from competition from countries that didn't impose similar restraints on climate-altering gases. What kind of protections are we talking about? Can we get every country in the world to go along with this sort of thing?
Well, this is one of the real problems, and what you have is you have American domestic politics going on. At the same time, you have these incredibly significant international talks that will come to a head in December in Copenhagen. And basically what you're seeing happening is that there's gaming where the U.S. has said for a long time that it doesn't want to take action on climate change unless it feels like there's significant action being taken by major emerging economies, including, say, China, India, Brazil, and South Africa. And so, again, to some extent, these things are contradictory. If we start penalizing other countries, for example, when they're trying to export their goods to us because of their carbon footprint, while that makes a lot of sense to Americans, it may be a real impediment to brokering a global deal on climate change, which is what the administration is hoping to do by the end of the year.
Now, Elizabeth, I mentioned that other concern about Wall Street getting into this at a time when people are rather suspicious of anything that involves Wall Street. Don't people have cause to be wary of creating a new market for carbon in light of the way that the market has performed recently?
Well, I mean, this is, you know, one of the ironies of our system. I mean, as I said at the beginning, the cap and trade system really, if in sort of economic theory, once again, is the moral equivalent or the economic equivalent, if it's, you know, designed properly, of a tax. So you could just put a tax on carbon, but there's so much political resistance to that we've sort of gone the route of a cap and trade. Now people are saying, well, we don't want that because that involves a market. Well, that's sort of the whole point. If you don't have a carbon market, you don't have a cap and trade bill. So unfortunately, you know, we can just go around and around and sort of point fingers. You can, if you want to, give people, you know, an economic incentive to, you know, cut their carbon emissions, which is what people say they want, as opposed to just, you know, rationing carbon, which we could also do, then you're going to have to use market forces. And the way you could do that is either to put a tax on or create a carbon market. And to sort of, you know, now raise this sort of, you know, shibboleth of, well, now Wall Street's going to get involved, seems to me to be sort of disingenuous, to be honest. And the other point I'd make about, you know, the senator from North Dakota is there were a lot of concessions made in this bill, and indeed many people would say far too many concessions made in this bill to agricultural interests. And you can, there are provisions in the bill where you can buy what are called offsets, which are basically, instead of you reducing your carbon emissions, you can basically pay someone else to do that. And the agriculture can be, you know, sort of counted in this mix, different ways of farming. And at the agricultural community won a lot of concessions, including having the Agriculture Department regulate these things instead of the Environmental Protection Agency, et cetera. So really, the farm interests won a lot in this bill. And now to say sort of, oh, but we don't want Wall Street involved, as I say, that seems to me that's kind of after the fact. That's kind of an argument we really can't have at this point.
Well, hasn't oil speculation been blamed on the erratic fluctuation in gasoline prices that we've seen recently? Why should we assume it would be any different with emissions credits?
Well, I mean, obviously, whenever you do create a market, I don't want to, you know, be here sitting here as a defender of Wall Street in 2009. When you create a market, you do create the possibility of market manipulation. But if you, once again, believe in using the markets, then you have to believe that the markets will sort themselves out. If you don't believe that, then there's a lot of things about capitalism that you just don't believe in.
Well, a listener, Richard from Larchmont, asked, why not just give incentives for cleaner factories and reactors?
Incentives?
In other words, give economic incentives and encourage people to just do it because we're helping them to do the right thing.
Well, those have also, you know, traditionally been subject to terrible manipulation. I mean, once again, we are looking for the most efficient system. And if we start handing out, for example, you know, you can do that. You could hand out tax credits. We do that now. That's another way of doing it. Once again, all these instruments, you know, to a certain extent rely on the same principles.
In the end, won't people end up paying for this bill through higher prices?
Well, you know, to be frank, that's the point. If you want to encourage people to save, to use less fossil fuel energy, then you've got to make them, you know, pay more for fossil fuel energy. That is the point. That's often obscured in this debate, once again, for political reasons. But that is the point, that you would encourage people to use less because they would be paying more for it. Now, the CBO has done an analysis of this and suggested that the net cost to people, once again, you would build a lot of, presumably get a lot of inefficiency out of the system by doing this, is something like $175 per year per family. So we're not talking about, you know, large costs to individual families.
Juliet, it's been reported that the White House has been deeply involved behind the scenes in shaping health care reform legislation. Is a similar thing happening with the cap and trade system?
Actually, they haven't been that involved in shaping the legislation itself. They did get involved in terms of helping lobby to pass the House bill and would be expected to do the same thing on the Senate side. But interestingly, they've deferred a lot to Congress on this, partially because, again, they've been consumed with the health care debate. This is one of the tough questions, that does the White House have enough capital to push through both an ambitious health reform bill as well as a climate change bill? And so what they're really looking for is, they had a lot of faith in, frankly, Henry Waxman, who's got a long record on this issue and is an extremely experienced legislator, and now they're waiting to see whether the Senate can broker a deal. But there are risks involved with that, both because, you know, again, they're not having as much of a role in shaping it, and then also they're the ones who are going to have to go to the international arena in December. And they've been pretty clear that they won't commit to anything that goes beyond what's passed as part of legislation in Congress.
Haven't a number of states created their own emissions trading alliances? Are they going to be factored into the national bill?
Well, you're right that there are a number of regional alliances, both in the Northeast and in the West and so forth. Essentially, all of the states that have done this have also called for federal leadership on this issue. So essentially, what they do will be folded into whatever national plan we come up with.
Now we have a number of senators, I think all Republicans, who don't believe that global warming even exists. How is that going to be dealt with in Congress?
Well, I mean, you're right that there are definitely some. I mean, again, there's a significant number of members in the Republican Party, both in the House and Senate, who have questioned climate change, although you hear a little less of that in the Senate. I mean, essentially, one of the things is that, and this is somewhat different from healthcare, that basically the administration is well aware that whatever deal they cut is going to have to be cut within the Democratic Party, that they really can't rely on Republican votes except for maybe a tiny, tiny handful. And that just makes their job tougher. But basically, they're getting very little cooperation from the GOP on this. And in fact, one of the interesting things that came up from a political perspective is Mark Kirk, who's a moderate Republican on the House side, he voted for the climate change bill in the House, and he is now running for the Senate. And basically, his party was almost not going to back him because of the fact that he had voted for the climate bill in the House. So it shows you kind of what opposition there is within the GOP to this legislation.
Elizabeth, the listener, points out that Senator Dorgan is from North Dakota, which is a major coal producer. So that may be a reason that he brought up Wall Street as a concern, because he didn't want to bring up coal as a concern.
That's quite possible. I mean, clearly, and as you mentioned at the top of the hour, there was a letter recently from 10 Democratic senators, several of them from coal states. I mean, what we might call coal states. I mean, there really actually aren't that many states where coal producing is a major industry, but where coal-powered utilities are a major industry.
And the president was a major proponent of the so-called clean coal approach during the campaign.
Well, the so-called clean coal, and I'm glad that you used that phrase, because it's not always clear that it in fact exists. What people mean by clean coal nowadays usually is that you would take the CO2, carbon dioxide, out of the waste stream of a coal plant, and you would inject it underground, essentially, presumably, if a test showed you that it would stay there for the long range, then we would, sort of call that clean coal. But there really are no plants in this country that are commercially operational using clean coal technology, and there are a lot of questions, both technological and economic, about whether, there ever will be. But they're not at all incompatible, because if the idea is, well, you can no longer just, emit CO2 for nothing, then you have to think of strategies to reduce your CO2 emissions. Well, one of them would be, what's called carbon capture and storage. That's this clean coal technology, but it's costly. It doesn't make any sense to do it if you can emit all that CO2 into the air for nothing. If you suddenly have to pay for it, then it might make sense. So those two, paths, or parallel paths, or intersecting paths, they are not in any way contradictory paths.
Now, we've pretty much run out of time, but Congress is probably going to pass some kind of legislation. If it's relatively toothless, is it worth all the effort?
Well, I think a lot of people would, take issue with the first part of your statement. Is Congress probably going to pass something? I don't know that we know that, but I think that because of the insignificance of the climate talks in Copenhagen, as Juliet mentioned, we need something. We certainly, toothy would be a lot better than toothless, but we certainly need to take a first step. If we are just completely deadlocked here in this country going into international talks, it's hard to imagine how, in good faith, any other country could agree to do anything either.
Juliet, you think that it's going to pass?
Oh, I agree with Elizabeth. I think it's entirely unclear. I mean, certainly, it definitely could, but there's certainly as likely a chance that they can't come to an agreement. And certainly, and even if the Senate does act, there are clearly going to be differences between the Senate and House bill, and whether they can resolve that to send legislation on to the president remains unclear as well.
Well, on that happy note, I thank the two of you. The Washington Post, Juliet Alperin, the New Yorker's Elizabeth Colbert. Colbert, we've been talking about cap and trade, one of the legislative leftovers of Congress, perhaps to be passed in the fall, perhaps not. It's been a real pleasure, I guess.
Thanks so much.
Thanks for having us.